Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that the following story contains the names of people who have died.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 225, Buiti Binafi, and Bienvenidos Bitches.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening and being here with us. Now, Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and those who are othered, and the victims, because contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender, able-bodied white dudes. And
what?
These crimes rarely get any public attention because the news, and gosh, after going down under for this case, not just the news, but a lot of other things are racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman, and I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists, just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions.
All right, so who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today, we're talking about Dennis Rostron, an Aboriginal Australian man who shot and killed his family at Mulgawo Outstation in Arnhem Land in 1988. And this subject was suggested to us by our fruity Satari.
Oh, thank you so much. That deserves a hip-hop air horn.
Yeah.
We appreciate you so, so very much. Where is it? There it is.
Whoa!
Sorry.
Coming in
I'm
hot.
I'm still dialing this in, but thank you, Satari. Satari is a fruity. Well, before we get into it, friend, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I've been working. So.
Yeah, yeah, work.
Just work.
Exactly. Yeah, there's so much.
Today was a long day.
It was for, yeah, I'm sorry, friend. I'm right there with you in the trenches.
Yeah.
I'm busy as well.
Yeah.
And it just don't stop, won't stop.
Yep. I have a long to-do list as well.
Yeah. The to-do lists. But we're here. And this is actually the fun part of our day.
Yes, it is.
So let's get into something that makes it all the more sweeter. Listener letters, messages from y'all. So, here we go.
Well, hello, angels. Thank you.
Do a little neck stretch. All right, Beth, what is in that bag?
Well, I wanted to say thank you to Momo for your sweet Instagram DM. We really appreciated it.
Mm-hmm. We did. Yeah. We did. It was really beautiful. We're not going to share everything he said, but certainly we were just really grateful that that resonated enough with you for you to respond and let us know. And we are just really grateful. So hip hop air horns.
Yeah. And then we got an email from April W. And April says that she listens to the podcast while cleaning the house to make it go faster.
So hip hop air horns to April W. Thank you for your lovely email. And to all the fruities who listen to us while cleaning the house and getting shit done. Amen. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And if you have any questions or comments, please send them to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at
602-935-6294.
And we may feature it on a future episode. But if you don't want us to, just let us know and we won't.
It's as easy as that.
Yep.
So wanted to say thank you to Sharonia P. for the handsome Cash App donation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Sharonia. So much. And here's your tune. Why do you build me up, Sharonia, baby, just to help us out, and play your spot loud, and then worst of all, thank you so much, Sharonia.
Yeah, thank you.
So now we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to get into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's better, HELP.com/fruit.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcasts, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
All right, we are back. Remind us, Beth, who is our subject today?
Our subject is Dennis Dembiri Rostron, who shot and killed his wife, two sons, and his parents-in-law at Malgao Station in Arnhem Land in 1988.
Down under. That's where it happened. So now we are going to get to the love and light section where we say rest in power to the victims and also love and light to the loved ones and community left in the wake of this tragic case. One of the documentaries I saw said that when an Aboriginal family member dies, the family dies with it.
Oh.
And so again, rest in power to the victims. They are Cicely Rostron, who was 23 years old. That was the perp's wife. Dick Murumuru, who was 67. That was the perp's father-in-law. Dolly Murumuru, 26 years old. That was the perp's mother-in-law. Preston was a 3-year-old boy, and Zorak was a 21-month-old little boy. So again, rest in power to them. Now let's get into the setting. Beth, take us there.
The setting is Arnhem Land, Australia. Australia is both the world's largest island and its smallest continent.
Hmm.
Much of the center is desert, but it also has rainforests along its coasts, and the north is tropical. And prior to European invasion, Aborigines occupied all of Australia.
Yeah, and racism is universal. It's all over the world.
Yeah.
And if you thought that it would have been a little bit lighter because they're down under, you were wrong. So Australia's Aboriginal culture probably represents the oldest surviving culture in the world, with the use of stone tool technology dating back at least 65,000 years. Aboriginal language and culture varies in different regions. And at the time of European invasion, I think white Australians call it maybe encroachment. They try to use really benign terms to diminish the horrors that white Europeans inflicted upon the Aboriginal folks. But at the time of European invasion, Australia had over 400 different tribes, each with their own language and traditions.
Yeah, so they're not a monolith.
They're not a monolith, and they're not, they're still here, and they're still fighting for their rights and their land and their autonomy and all the things.
Yep. In 1623, the Dutch East India Company sailed into the Gulf of Carpentaria and named Cape Arnhem after the ship, the Arnhem, which itself was named after the city of Arnhem in the Netherlands.
Hmm. City already had a name.
They did. And I don't think they landed. I think they just named it and took off.
Oh, you know, I'm watching Shogun, and that's what it seems like they were doing. Like
a lot of,
Just so you know, we own this.
We own this.
But
bye.
You've never been here. You don't know nothing about me or this place. What are you talking about? Oh my gosh. So while European influence began in 1788 in the Sydney region of Southeast Australia, it did not reach Central Australia until the 1880s. Many Aboriginal groups in these remote areas were virtually unchanged by European influence until the 1940s, and the last traditional nomadic families moved from the desert regions to settlements in 1960s. They didn't do it voluntarily.
No.
They were told the land didn't belong to them. It belonged to somebody else.
Get out.
They had to leave. Yeah.
In the 1970s, something called the Outstation Movement arose and continued through the 1980s. This movement saw the creation of remote settlements of Aboriginal people, and they called them outstations.
So outstations are small, decentralized, and relatively permanent communities of kin established by Aboriginal people on land that has social, cultural, or economic significance to them. The majority of outstations have fewer than 40 people.
These people relocated themselves from the towns and settlements where they had been settled by the government's policy of assimilation as a move towards reclaiming autonomy and self-sufficiency and to escape the problems of the larger towns. These population groups have very little Western cultural influence, and many of the outstations are in Arnhem Land.
Arnhem Land is a wild and untamed landscape defined by rocky escarpments, gorges, rivers, and waterfalls in the northeast corner of Australia's Northern Territory. It's roughly the size of Iceland, covering about 97,000 square kilometers, and that's 37,000 square miles for dumb Americans. And is bigger than Hungary, Portugal, and Austria.
It has remained the same for centuries. It's home to the Yolngu people, and permits are required to visit. Arnhem Land is also the home of Australia's most famous musical instrument, the didgeridoo.
Oh, I love it. And I was reminded in researching this case what it sounded like.
Oh, yeah.
And I've never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
It's really
very
cool.
Different.
Yeah. Arnhem Land has a total population of approximately 16,000 people, of whom 12,000 are Aboriginal Yolngu people, the traditional owners of the land. A substantial portion of the population lives on small outstations or homelands.
Arnhem Land is one of the last areas in Australia that could be seen as a completely separate country. In fact, many of the region's leaders have called and continue to call for a treaty that would allow the Yolngu to operate under their own traditional laws.
Aboriginal people today live across the full spectrum of change from traditional Aboriginal culture to European culture. At one end of the spectrum are family groups living in outstations away from larger Aboriginal communities, trying to maintain traditional hunting, food, gathering, and ceremonial life.
But even at this level, people now wear clothes, may own a car or four-wheel drive vehicle, and the men will hunt with rifles as well as spears. In the middle are people living in larger Aboriginal communities, buying most of their food and other needs from the local store, occasionally carrying out traditional hunting and food gathering, and trying to maintain traditional ceremonies and rituals. At the other end of the spectrum are urban Aborigines living European lifestyles and treasuring their Aboriginal ancestry.
Aboriginal people have complex social and marriage laws based on the grouping of people within their society. The smallest physical group is the family. The members of the group who all speak the same language can be considered a tribe or language group, and each tribe belongs to a specific tribal land.
At the time of European colonization, the number of individuals in a tribe ranged from about 400 to 600, with an average being about 450. A tribe is like a small country with its own language. Some tribal groups also use the term nation to describe themselves.
Tribes were generally not a war-making group. They were not led by a chief, and people usually used their moiety, or skin name, to describe themselves individually, rather than their tribal name. What is a moiety, and what is a skin name? Well, let's get into it.
Moiety is a kinship system in Aboriginal communities that describes two separate groups of people within one community. The term comes from Latin and means half. In moiety systems, society is divided into two halves, with each group coexisting with the other.
People belong to groups which have totems or totemic beings. A totem is an animal, plant, or other object believed to be ancestrally related to a person. Because people regard these totems as their ancestors, they are also referred to as ancestral beings.
The members of each group associated with a particular ancestral being or totem are said to belong to a clan. They have common territory and totems and their own clan name. Their senior person is described as the clan leader.
Oh, I just was just going to say about totems and spirit animals.
Uh-huh.
You know how people joke around about it? Like,
yeah,
I'm the last on the totem pole. Or, I don't know. Donald
Something
Trump's my spirit animal.
My spirit animal, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, best to avoid those if you don't really have a familiarity with this culture. I would avoid it.
It's an offhand comment
that
could be offensive.
Yeah, so
and,
that's all.
Just don't do it.
Yeah, just avoid it if you can, that's all. But the number of different groups in a region varies throughout Australia. When people divide themselves into two main groups, these are called moieties. When they divide themselves into four groups, they're referred to as sections. And when they are divided into eight or more groups, they're called subsections.
When people divide themselves into sections and subsections, these groups are what Aboriginal people refer to as their skin. And the name of the group to which a person belongs is their skin name. It's similar to a surname as it indicates a person's bloodline. It demonstrates how generations are linked and how they should relate.
The skin name might be the name of an animal, plant, or inanimate object, and each person has a special religious connection with their totem or totems within their group. Skin names are often shared across tribal boundaries, and these form part of the Aboriginal kinship system, where distant people form bonds and relationships with each other.
Aboriginal society also defines the relationship between people based on their age and birth. The leaders of society are the elders. Important decisions are made by a council of elders, which include clan leaders and the most respected elders of the tribe.
Some Aboriginal tribes have separate names for up to 70 family relationship terms. So that means it's important. I mean, if there's that many words for it, that's a...
Yeah, their family relationships are very important to
them. So like in European society, they use terms like mother, father, son, daughter, aunt, uncle, niece, nephew, etc. Aboriginal tribes might have as many as 70 different ways to describe these types of relationships. That's so cool.
Yeah. Under their family and society rules, people have obligations toward certain relatives, and these obligations are reciprocated. For example, amongst many tribes, a man has an obligation to care for his brother's children, his nieces and nephews, more so than his own children. And then, you know, his brother would be expected to care for his children.
I just think that's so wonderful. Do you get into how the Australian government used children as weapons?
No.
Well, there was this scandal and white Australian government officials started going into the Aboriginal communities and started this rumor that was totally false that Aboriginal people were harming their children and molesting their children. Oh, and geez. So then the government just came in and took like a whole bunch of children and took them out of their families' homes, then adopted them out to white families. And then they ended up being mostly like domestic servants, paid little to nothing for a long time. So,
yeah, I remember, I think I mentioned this in the last story that we covered in Australia. Mm-hmm. There's a movie called Rabbit Proof Fence.
Oh.
And it's about that kind of practice, taking the Aboriginal children away from the families. It's a story of these Ooh. Kids who get taken away and then they run away.
Oh, man.
And yeah, it's really sad.
Okay. But I mean, I'm putting it on my watch list.
Yeah.
You know, I found myself really just seeing the parallels and also appreciating the nuances that I was able to find in this culture and this story. Yeah. And so any opportunity to learn more, I'm going to take it. So one of the rules under the kinship system is Aboriginal avoidance practices, which refers to those relationships in traditional Aboriginal society where certain people are required to avoid others in their family or clan. These customs are still active in many parts of Australia. There are also protocols for averting eye contact and not speaking the names of the dead.
One of the most common avoidance practices is between a son or daughter-in-law and a mother-in-law. Some Australian Aboriginal customs ban a person from talking directly to their mother-in-law or even seeing her.
Sounds great, am I right? just kidding. So there are different speculations around how this practice came about. The age of marriage is very different for men and women in Aboriginal society, with girls usually marrying at puberty, while a man may not marry until his late 20s or even later.
As mothers-in-law and sons-in-law might be of approximately the same age, the avoidance practice possibly serves to circumvent potential illicit relationships. It has also been suggested that the custom developed to overcome a common cause of friction within families. Mother-in-laws.
Yeah, I can't say I'm mad at it. I mean, in any case, this custom bans a person from talking directly to their mother-in-law and vice versa. This rule applies to both men and women talking to their mother-in-law. To allow this rule to work, communication takes place via a third person. So if you wanted your mother-in-law to do something for you, you might ask your spouse or another person, please ask your mother to do so-and-so for me. And I mean, that seems like a great way to avoid conflict. If you're asking
conflict,
me.
Yeah. Yeah. Another common avoidance practice is not naming the dead. Traditionally, this meant avoiding referring to a dead person by name directly after their death as a mark of respect, and also because it's considered too painful for the grieving family. And there may also be an element of not wanting to disturb the dead.
Right, to disturb the spirit that is on its way to rest in peace.
Yeah. The avoidance period may last 1 or more years.
One might refer to the person in a roundabout way, but not use their name. In some Aboriginal societies, there is a period where the name cannot be said, even if it's being used by another person. So that person might choose a different name to be used during this period.
And our story today takes place in Malgawa, an outstation near Gunbalanya, Northern Territory. Gunbalanya, historically referred to as Onpelli, is an Aboriginal Australian town in West Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory of Australia, about 300 kilometers or 190 miles east of Darwin.
So now we're going to get into Dennis Doombiri Rostron's early life. So he was born the son of Mandarg of the Balang clan of Eastern Arnhem Land to the son Totem. Mandarg was born in 1915, had 4, possibly 5 wives and 18 children total. And by the way, you know, polyamory in Aboriginal Australian culture is complex. So it's not like just it's a different culture, so we think of it differently.
Yes.
But Dennis was his 12th child, born to his first wife, Rosie Maljabi, in 1963.
Rosie was born in 1925, and she was a strong-willed woman.
Mm.
By the 1970s, she had separated from Mandarg, set up a home on the other side of the camp, and announced, quote, "I am now divorced," unquote.
I love it. I love that so much. Put it on a t-shirt. She encouraged her daughters to be independent as well. If they had any trouble with their men, they were encouraged to leave and come back to stay with their mother. Her daughters were described as spirited, whereas her sons were described as laid back.
Mandarg has been described as a dominant father with unquestionable authority. His sons went to him for advice and they, quote, followed his orders without delay, unquote.
Dennis wasn't the only son of Mandarg who got himself into some trouble. In December of 1966, another son, David Galbuma, 19, murdered a woman and attacked her six-year-old cousin because he was with her. The boy survived. This was to be considered one of the last ritual spearing murders in Arnhem Land.
During the trial, it came out that he was ordered to kill the woman by his elders because she was suspected of having a role in the deaths of her husband and their two newborn children, although the deaths could have been attributed to disease.
The prosecutor suggested an alternate motivation, that David had wanted to marry the woman, but was thwarted because she was the wrong skin type. This was described as the quote-unquote white explanation, having to do more with, quote, white wishes than black reality, unquote. And that quote took my breath away.
Yeah, really.
It's just a complete lack of cultural competency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it makes me think back on some other cases that we covered.
Yeah.
And the explanations for why they did things. And we might have been completely wrong.
Yeah. Seriously. I wonder who, if anybody took the time to, like, you know, ask. That's another thing I noticed, too, about in this research is everybody's like, what are we going to do about the Aboriginal problem? Oh, they must like being poor. They must like their circumstances. It's their fault, like punishing them. But nobody has asked them what they needed. Like all these programs and government people who are coming
trying
in.
Trying to fix them, but not asking them what the actual problem
what
is.
What do you need? Hey,
yeah.
What do you
You're
need
asking
done?
The wrong question. It makes me think of Night Country.
Yeah. And it just reminds me of something we've said and we've heard listeners say when we get it wrong, like not about us, without us. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Just cultural competency is quite important. That's all I'm trying to say, and I'm going to shut up now, I promise.
Ohio is a land of mystery, from missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people, to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app, and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.
So David was found guilty, but the judge took into consideration his Aboriginal culture and beliefs, and he was sentenced to only 4 years.
I think that's really interesting, too, that judges do that.
Yeah.
Dennis Rostron had a bit of history of flying off the handle. In 1985, he was 21. he got into an argument with Rebecca Judge Amir over her refusal to make tea. He picked up a shotgun and fired it over her head. Father, George, took her away to live somewhere else.
Probably a good choice.
Bullet
yeah.
dodged. literally. So now let's get into the timeline. Hit it, Beth.
In 1988, Rostron, who was 24 at the time, was living with his wife, Cecily, 23, and their two sons, Preston, 3, and Zarak, 21 months, at Malgawa, Cecily's parents' outstation.
Dick Murumuru was a well-known artist from Oipeli. He and his wife, Dolly, moved to Malgawa to be with family and to get away from outside influences. He was described as, quote-unquote, happy fella, who enjoyed painting and hunting.
Dick and old Lofty Najambarek, another artist and elder in the community, both felt it was their duty to look after their traditional homeland. They were a permanent fixture at the outstation.
Rostron later said that he was worried about the marriage. He said that he was crying sometimes, feeling sad, and thinking about killing himself. Tension between Rostron and his father-in-law, Dick Murumuru, as well as constant arguments with Cecily, filled him with anger.
It has been reported that the week before the murders, Rostron and Dick argued when Dick accused Rostron of speaking to his wife, Dolly, which was forbidden under the tribal avoidance practices, because Dolly was his mother-in-law.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Cecily was away at the time, and when she returned, she sided with her father, culminating in her telling Rostron that their sons were not actually his. That's a hell of a piece of news to deliver.
Yeah.
The family then isolated Rostron and would not let him near the children or give him food over a period of a couple of days.
On Friday, September 23rd, Cecily left for Jabiru to sell some of her father's paintings and to pick up some supplies. In order to get in and out of the outstation, they used chartered planes. Before she flew out, Rostron asked her to pick up some batteries for his tape recorder.
You know what I was just thinking? Like, I had to go today to the post office for a show. And it was like the mental preparation that I had to do. And then I had to go to a second store. And like, it was too much. If I had to get on a plane just
to do
for
those
supplies, I don't know if I could do it.
Of course, she probably wouldn't do it that often. So
I
that might make up for it.
I guess. But I'm just saying that, I'm so spoiled. I'm so privileged in so many ways. Wow. So in Jabiru, Cecily sold the paintings and then went to the supermarket to buy groceries, but she forgot the batteries. Then she flew back to Malgawa.
When Rostron found out that she had forgotten the batteries, he became angry. Cecily apologized, but he grabbed her around the neck and pushed her.
Mm.
Dick then intervened, spoke strongly to Rostron, and got his son-in-law to calm down.
The next day was better. Rostron went hunting and shot 2 emu. When you live in the bush, a good hunt makes people very happy. Rostron was pleased with himself, and Dick was too. But the next day, September 25th, Rostron was angry with Cecily again when she didn't cook his breakfast.
This soon gave way to his anger over the batteries again. Once more, Dick intervened, pointing out that there were very few people living at Magawa and they needed to get along.
It was very hot that day, 45 degrees Celsius or 113 Fahrenheit. Dick was resting in the shade. Rostron and Cecily also rested in the shade, but continued to squabble. Suddenly, Rostron rose, walked off, and then came back with a shotgun.
The first blast went over Cecily's head. Cecily shielded her 2 children in her arms as Rostron reloaded and shot her dead. He then reloaded again and shot both of his sons, Preston, 3, and Zorak, 21 months.
The idea of doing that to such a small, like, human body
is horrifying. Yeah, I can't even.
Yeah, thank you. Took the words out of my mouth. So he then shot Dick and Dolly. Witnesses said that by this point, Rostron was screaming, but there were no words. Rostron also shot a number of other people, or he shot at a number of other people at the outstation as they fled, but he did not hit anyone else.
Esau Judge Amir and his cousin Abraham, both 12, Shirley Judge Amir and Natricia Norarga, both 16, and 2 of the elders, Lena Norarga and Andrew Norarga, all fled. Rostron shot at Andrew as he ran, but missed him. However, shortly afterwards, Andrew dropped dead of a heart attack.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The rest headed east as Rostron headed west. They set off on foot without food or water across the Arnhem Land in escarpment. Remember, it's really, really hot. They emerged at a mining camp 3 days later, 80 kilometers or 50 miles away. So now let's get into the investigation and the arrest. What do you got for us, Beth?
On Tuesday, September 27th, Old Lofty's daughter, June Nanjambarak, flew into Malgawa. She was a nurse and was there to conduct medical checkups. When the plane landed at the airstrip, nobody came to meet it, which was unusual. June then walked down to the settlement and found the bodies.
The pilot radioed Jabiru with the news. An early rumor among the Aborigines blamed white shooters from a buffalo eradication program. But when it was learned that Rostron was not among the dead, and people remembered how he had shot above the head of Rebecca, Judge Amir, with a shotgun, they began to suspect that he was involved.
So the initial thought that it was white people was not,
It's not unusual. It's not out of the question. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Again, often white people were continuing to, like, bother them.
Right.
And, again, come in, you know, guns blazing, like, I'm the whites. The whites are here.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like, making decisions, picking up people, just disrupting their lives.
Yeah. The immediate impulse was to get Rostron. In tribal custom, it's an eye for an eye. One of the elders said, quote, in law, if someone to do that out in the bush and a lot of people are around, they would do the same thing to him. You know, just take his life, same as what he did, unquote.
Rostron had headed northwest toward Korlo Birada, his family's camp, about 50 kilometers or 32 miles from Malgawa. For several days, he hid in the bush near Korlo Birada. He still had the shotgun. It is believed that he spent that time trying to figure out what to do, surrender or keep hiding.
Police set up operations in Malgawa, bringing in men and equipment via a cargo plane. They began a ground and air search using helicopters. The people of Arnhem Land had never seen such intense police activity, and many were frightened.
I was also going to say, police activity costs money.
Yeah.
Can you imagine
a lot of money
if
was
the
spent.
Money they had used to try to catch this person or go into these communities had been used to just give it to them and help instead of all the other stuff. Just wonder.
Yeah.
When police came to Korlo Birada to search, Rostron's mother, Rosie Maljabi, fled into the bush. She was never seen again. Or at least she was still missing in 2021, which is the last that I can find mention of her.
Yeah. So if she's been found, let us know.
Yes, please.
Yeah. At 9:30 p.m. October 4th, Rostron walked into Meningrida, 65 kilometers or 40 miles north of Korlo Birada. He had a meal with a relative and then turned himself into the police. He was charged the next morning with 5 counts of murder.
All right, so now we're going to get into the trial. Let me tell you. So Rostron admitted to the killings, but pleaded not guilty to the murder on the basis of diminished responsibility related to depression, impairing his capacity, and provocation. In 1990, Rostron was tried and found guilty on 5 counts of murder and sentenced to life in prison with no prospect of parole.
However, in 2003, he became eligible for parole following changes to life sentencing laws, which allowed people who had been sentenced to life in prison for multiple murders to be given a non-parole period of 25 years.
Okay. In 2013, his non-parole period was increased to 28 years by Northern Territory Supreme Court Justice Judith Kelly, following a request from the Director of Public Prosecutions. In handing down her decision in 2013, Justice Judith Kelly, say that 5 times fast, said, quote, I am satisfied that because of the objective and subjective factors affecting the relative seriousness of the offense, a non-parole period longer than 25 years is warranted, unquote.
Justice Kelly also told the court that she would have given Rostron a longer non-parole period if he was not an Aboriginal man. Quote, the life expectancy of Aboriginal men is 52.5 years. For non-Aboriginal territory men, 64.7.
Wow.
If it had not been for Mr. Rostron's ill health and the concomitant risk that a very long non-parole period may well be an actual life sentence for him, I would have considered a non-parole period of at least 30 years to be warranted, unquote.
Yeah, but I don't know how, I mean, that stat that of life expectancy is quite grim.
Staggering.
Yeah. And that's,
I'd be dead already.
Oh my God, Beth. But a lot of the life expectancy issues have to do with racism.
Yeah.
And racism impact on bodies that are not white. But the judge also commented on his situation leading up to the horrific mass shooting. Quote, his marriage was breaking down. He was being treated badly by his wife and his in-laws and excluded from the family. And his parental right to his own children was being challenged, unquote.
At the time, Justice Kelly said she was not prepared to make a finding he would not reoffend, adding, quote, I accept he has incentive not to reoffend, but one would have thought he had even stronger incentive before, natural love and affection for his children, unquote.
That is a pickle.
Yeah.
Rostron had been in custody since he turned himself into authorities in September of 1988, making him one of the Northern Territory's longest serving prisoners. So now we're going to get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Dennis Rostron became eligible for parole after he had served 28 years in prison. The parole was granted in 2019 when he was 55. On granting his parole, the judge, Justice Southwood, reportedly insisted the community had been consulted about his release at length and now supported the decision.
The parole board was reportedly satisfied that Rostron had obtained a low security rating, had completed required rehabilitation and reintegration programs, and had a realistic post-release plan, including the ability to earn an income from the sales of his art. In prison, Rostron learned to read and write and taught other inmates how to paint.
Today, Rostron lives in an outstation near Manangreta with his extended family. He's employed doing activity work, and I'm not 100% sure what that is, but a little Googling suggests that it's temporary work for specified activities. So he might do some labor here, some labor there.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And he also sells his artwork across the territory.
Aha. Uh-huh. A family relation who refers to him as Grandpa said they all felt extremely happy when Dennis came home. Quote, he's happy every day. He's happy being with us families and he lives with us, unquote.
Introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
So now we're going to get into our thoughts. Beth, I'm sure you got some spicy hot takes on this case. So what do you think about this?
So not knowing, we briefly went over the Aboriginal culture, but, you know, I've never met an Australian Aboriginal person. I don't know the culture inside and out, never lived there, never been there.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. I do know that this was shocking for everybody.
Yeah.
This crime, the Aboriginal people, the Europeans, everybody.
Yeah.
And I wonder if living at his wife's outstation with his wife's family, there weren't a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who lived there were not his family.
Yeah.
I wonder if he felt isolated.
I think so too. I also, you know, I didn't know that he was illiterate. And I also wonder.
I didn't either until, yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I just think that may have added to the isolation.
Yeah.
I don't know if the other people around him were also illiterate, but my suspicion was that can be isolating as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like he didn't know what to do with his anger, like he'd pop off.
Right, right.
Yeah, he had no
outlet. Or ways of coping that may have been healthy.
Coping skills.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what we learned about his early life, his mom taught his sisters to be independent. But what did she teach her sons? And what is his father teach them? I don't know either.
Great question. Yeah.
And it sounds like when this occurred, he was out of his mind with rage. And this is not an excuse, just an observation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was described as screaming as he shot the family, but not saying anything, just screaming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sounds go ahead.
I am so sorry to cut you off, but about they didn't feed him for days. So lack of food, isolation, and frustration. That could drive anybody mad.
Poor relationship with his wife and his in-laws and living at this outstation where his family was not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of that was probably stressors.
Yeah, yeah.
And he never learned how to cope with his emotions.
Yeah, I think that you're right. Agreed. I had many thoughts about this case. First of all, racism in Australia is fucking wild in that they essentially did the things that all the other Western nations did to Indigenous and Black people in their countries.
Yeah.
Took their land, enslaved them, kept them from resources and rights, disenfranchised them. And Australia is doing something similar that we are doing here. And that's trying to not talk about it and take it out of all of the history
books. To pretend it
never
happened.
Pretend it didn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like there's this day called the Australia Day, and they celebrate the formation of Australia, and Aboriginal people aren't getting down with that. It's a celebration for who? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And let's see, what else did I thought that you already haven't said? You know, I was just going to say he fled immediately because he knew what he did was wrong, and he stayed hidden for over a week.
Yeah, I think it was like 10
days. Because he knew what he did was wrong. And I am always surprised and fascinated by the I blacked out defense. You know, I've never been that angry where I don't remember being angry.
What I did.
And if I'm being honest, I've never had the freedom to do that because I'm a Black woman in America.
Yeah.
But I do like envy people who are just allowed to get mad. And be mad in public and break things and throw things. And that's, it's so wrapped up in that emotion that you can't remember what you're doing, despite it being horrifying and really bad. It's just, I don't know what to make of it. I'm not smart enough. But I did have thoughts about it. What else? I just like he could have done so many other things. Like he got out of prison and he said, I saw a quote, "I'm a good person," he said. But gosh, if only you had come to that realization earlier, you know, then this
you're
tragedy.
You're a good person except the murdering.
Yeah. And that's
except
another.
That.
Yeah. Another thing about language, not to beat a dead horse, because we try to get things right here. But it might be better to refer to him rather as a murderer or people who kill and who, people are capable of change, a person who murders. I've heard prison abolitionists talk about that conversation about not calling people murderers or rapists, but calling them people who do a certain thing. There might be some mixed reviews and opinions about that thought.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In this sense, he did a horrible thing. He spent a lot of time in prison and now he's out, presumably not doing other horrible things.
Hopefully not.
So does the title still apply? I don't know.
I hope for his family's sake that he's changed.
Me too. And also,
and he may have learned a lot of coping skills in jail. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. And also just don't want to forget the impact that this had on the family and the community.
Yeah.
In which the people who were killed lost their
lives. Actually, Malgawa no longer exists.
What?
Because, they abandoned it after this happened.
As I said, when somebody dies, the whole family dies and they leave.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was their home. Yeah.
Yeah.
They just left.
Oh, that's
sad.
It's like a devastating cherry on top of a devastating sundae.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much. Well, now let us know what you think of the case. And if anything we left out that you think is important, feel free to get at us and let us know. So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
Okay, Beth, it looks like you've got something good. What is it?
I do. So as I was researching this story, sometimes I take breaks and watch TikToks. And I came across this creator. Her name is, her TikTok name is, or handle is at Zoe's a Crowd. Mm-hmm. And she's an Australian data activist who runs a website which compiles data about gender-based violence. And their aim is to make spaces safer for women and gender diverse people. So people on the LGBTQ spectrum.
Yeah,
you know.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And the video that I saw, it was really good.
Okay.
She had a video about bystander intervention and how to safely intervene as a bystander.
Lovely.
And it was on a bus or a train, a light rail, something like that.
Uh-huh.
A woman was wearing an Indigenous t-shirt, and I didn't see the t-shirt.
Okay.
Because it was like the video was from coming from her point of view.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't see the t-shirt. Mm-hmm. I'm just assuming it says Indigenous on it or something like that, but they were calling it an Indigenous t-shirt.
Okay.
And she is being verbally accosted by some grumpy old racist man.
Ugh.
Yeah. So Zoe, she like analyzed the video and pointed out ways in which the bystanders in this video helped this woman and different things you can do as a bystander. So one of the things was a woman said something to the man.
Okay.
I can't remember what it was, but something else that people did, which I can't remember what she called it, but it's like something you can do that it seems insignificant, but it's really helpful. These people walked by her and said, "Love your t-shirt."
Uh-huh.
And
it just disrupted the moment.
Yes, disrupted it and were like giving her positive feedback. And the woman who talked to the old man was telling him, "Oh, I remember." She said something like, "You can't talk to her like that. If you don't like her shirt, then you leave." You know, because he was saying something about how she should leave or something like that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
It literally is like a Care Bears stare moment.
But something else you can do as a bystander is just sit by the person who is being accosted and talk to them.
Yes.
And, you know.
Hey, sis, just, are you okay? Hey,
yes,
do you need anything?
Exactly.
Hey.
I like your t-shirt.
Just something so that person doesn't feel alone either.
Right.
That's a excellent tip. Thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
So Zoe's a Crowd on TikTok and their bystander video. I just was going to, this came up, health.gov.au, and it provides an alphabetical list of organizations in Australia to help victims and survivors of family, domestic, or sexual violence across the country.
Nice.
And that link will be in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
So now it's shout out time, where we shout out any content by people of color or about people of color or any other marginalized folks or any true crime goodies. So what do you got, Beth?
So I've been watching, or I started watching, a docuseries on Netflix called The Androni Mukherjee Story, Buried Truth.
Yeah.
Have you watched it?
I haven't yet. It's in my queue. Now, tell me more.
So it's a docuseries that investigates the murder of 25-year-old Sheena Boro.
Okay.
Who went missing in April of 2012 in Mumbai, India. So the setting is India.
Okay.
And I haven't finished it yet, but there's lots of wild family secrets. Ooh. And it's going places I didn't expect.
Ooh, okay, okay. I don't have much other than to say Shogun is the shit.
Yeah, it's really good.
I thought they would drop the whole thing, but they didn't. And so I have to wait
next week for a new episode.
Yeah.
But it is so, so good. I can't remember where I'm watching it. Hulu?
It's on Hulu.
Okay. Yeah. So the recap of those shoutouts are the Indrani Mukherjee story, Buried Truth on Netflix, as well as Shogun on Hulu. And oh me, oh my, it's the end of the episode. But we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show. Also, join us on Patreon, where we have literally hundreds of hours of bonus content. You can also support us by supporting our sponsors or by giving us a 5-star review.
Five stars only, please.
Also, don't forget to subscribe.
Also, if you are listening now to us on Google Podcasts, find a new favorite podcast app because it's going away and subscribe there.
Yes.
Also, this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Work.
Yeah, there's so much.
Okay.
Quick sip of the tea. I got one of those. It's not really a Stanley cup. It's a Yeti, but it keeps stuff so hot.
Nice. Oh,
this has saved me through winter. I would have been dead.
It has
cleaned my glasses. I'm sorry. That's all I'm trying to say, and I'm going to shut up now, I promise.
Mother-in-laws.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I'm mad at it. I mean.
I am now divorced, unquote.
Put it on a t-shirt.
Probably a good choice.
Bullet dodged. Literally. Oh, they started it. Oh,
yeah.
I missed that. Okay. Cut out everything I just said. Okay. So, I just so you know, we own this.
We own this. Bye.
But you've never been here. You don't know nothing about me or this place. What are you talking about? Oh my gosh.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Doesn't that remind you of someone else?
Yes, it does.
I see you over there, United States.
Right, hold on. Let me get a sip of tea. I've got a frog in my throat.
Oh, no. Get out of there, frog. We rebuke you. I thought we got rid of that guy.
Go away, frog. Okay.
Special cultural.
Social.
Sounds great. Am I right? just kidding. So in 2023, his non-parole period.
2013.
Gosh.
Historic. Sorry.
Just say whatever works for you. Okay. Corlo Birada.
Excellent.
Thank you. Corlo Birada.
You did it.
Thank you. He's sorry.
Bless you.
Rosie, thank you. Don't get murdered. Okay.
So, I mean, but you can do whatever you want.
I don't want to do it. Shit if there's out of everything. No. That's okay. You know what I've been doing lately because I've been so busy is like after I'll do something like take a sip of water or delete an email, I'll write on my to-do list, drink water and cross it off so I feel good about myself,
accomplishing something. Yeah.
My kids still think it's not a real place. We're never going there. It's. Disney who? my friend. Love you, Beth. Bye.
Bye.
The detective came and knocked on the door, and I said, "Is it Renee?" And he just gave me that solemn look.
It was the worst day ever.
The Proof Podcast is back with a new case and a new season. 23 years ago, 18-year-old Renee Ramos went missing. Her body was later found in an empty Home Depot building on the edge of town.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
She had a black eye about 2 weeks before she was murdered.
They are involved. They definitely had her body and her backpack.
You know people are going to judge you, right?
Of course. They're judging me now. They've been judging me damn near my whole life.
You can listen now to Season 2 of Proof wherever you get your podcasts. And follow along with us as we reinvestigate the murder at the warehouse.
I have to ask, did you kill Renee?
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderick.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.